Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, September 5th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, coming to you from the Futures Lab of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm your host, Mike McKeon, and as is the case most Wednesdays, I'm joined by regular panelists and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Our topics this week: the Democratic National Convention is now underway, and both parties have been pulling out the stops to attract women voters. So why do many of the news stories about this strategy, at least according to one analyst, quote, mostly men? The TV ratings for the conventions are down while social media engagement is up. We wonder if that's the new norm. Political reporters are complaining about how soul-sucking it is to cover this year's presidential campaign, though many of them have been partying hardy in Tampa and Charlotte. One media watcher says they may be taking out their frustrations on President Obama by describing him in stories this week as egotistical, selfish, and dull. A good journalist did a dumb thing at last week's GOP convention, saying into an open mic that the Republicans were, quote, happy to have a party with black people drowning. There's an old lesson with a new media twist in this one for every reporter. And what lesson should we draw from the revelation this week that a New York Times reporter sent the full text of an opinion piece to a government spokeswoman before it was published? Well, let's begin, as we've done the past couple of weeks, with coverage of the presidential candidates and their nominating conventions. By one measure, at least, TV ratings, the Republican convention fell flat. Audience numbers were down nearly a quarter from 4 years ago, and experts expect a similar drop for the Democrats. So, Lee, what do we make of that? The ratings are down. Why?
I suspect because people have other things to do. We've talked about this before, but in many ways, the conventions are foregone conclusions. If you put that together with the fact that the polling suggests, I don't know whether or not it's true, that most people have already made up their minds, what's the point in watching the convention?
Yeah, Charles, I mean, I think we saw some of those excuses in some of the stories. Well, you had Sarah Palin last time on the Republican side, and you had the first black nominee from a major party in 2008. Nothing surprising. It's all scripted. People have made up their minds. Oh, there was this little thing called a tropical storm that became a hurricane. The social media have risen. There's more competition. Which of those things resonate with you?
I think it's sort of a witch's brew of all the above. I mean, the hurricane / tropical storm was an outlier, and it'll be interesting to see whether, when we compare the Democratic National Convention, you can peel some of that drop away and attribute it to the tropical storm hurricane news, because that was covered wall to wall, and a lot of people were paying a lot of attention to it as it moved through the country. I do think the historic nature of the 2008 convention cannot be underestimated.
I think, too, though, at least the point of some of these stories, Lee, was that while TV ratings are down, despite or because of all the reasons we've talked about, social media around the conventions has been up. I mean, dramatically. Facebook posts, Twitter posts are way, way up during these two conventions. So why would we see, you know, the TV decline when people are so much more engaged online?
Well, I don't know that people are more engaged online. I mean, I think it's a little bit like your back fence neighbors or what have you. I also think that a lot of the posts have been shockingly encouraged by the various political parties. So, you know, the notion that you're not getting it on TV and you're going and getting something different online, I think there's some real flaws in that kind of logic.
I mean, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I do think there's something going on with the social media, Charles, but if you look at a study that was released this week by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, it actually raises some kind of interesting questions. Mm-hmm. About 75% to 2/3 of the Americans they talked to, people who use social media, said that they really didn't find that they were all that important for things having to do with politics, like discussing politics, recruiting other people to get involved in politics, to find people who agree with your views. So why would it be that social media use is up if people don't think that those tools are all that important to them?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I wonder if it doesn't go to, and you know, we'll continue to look at this, and researchers will start to trick out how people are actually using second screen environments in their viewing. And I have this sort of crackpot theory, at least in my own life, that it may be a second screen that's displacing the first screen. In other words, there were parts of the Republican National Convention I didn't watch because there was something else on that I found more compelling, but I was keeping an eye on it on the laptop sitting in my lap. And then when something really exploded on Twitter, I moved over and then I went back. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that, and that people are using the social networks almost as a viewing guide so that they can go watch the college football game they actually want to watch and then still keep an eye on things back in politics.
Yeah, there were some interesting demographic breakdowns in the survey. At least they were interesting to me. Perhaps not too surprising is that younger people and African Americans are more likely to say that they're enthusiastic about social media. But the most enthusiastic users of these social media were truly conservative Americans. I mean, they said these were our outlets when we have, well, they didn't say it in the survey, but I think we can infer their argument is these are media we can control.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some element of control. I think there's also some element of just feeling like you're being heard, which is interesting because you're broadcasting to the world, but actually no one may be listening. So there's some gratification, to use the academic term, and just being able to put whatever your view is out there. I mean, one of the criticisms from political conservatives for, you know, the past 30 to 40 years is we don't get heard. We don't have a voice. We don't have a place that's ours to talk in a way that's more or less unfiltered. Well, along comes social media, and there it is.
Well, another interesting thing we're not factoring into this is the role the DVR plays in American television viewing now. And so many of my friends, at least on the social networks, are watching things hours, if not days, mm-hmm. afterward, because they're just refusing to watch them live and wade through all those commercials. And so what does that do to the mediated and remediated communication of things that are watched, you know, 3 days later?
Well, and there's also the sense that if you missed, for example, Clint Eastwood's, I'm going to call it a performance because I don't know what else to call it because he didn't have a script. But if you miss Clint Eastwood at the Republican convention, there's all kinds of alternative venues that you can go and now see that and just that. And much of that is social media.
You know, one of the thoughtful writers, not winging it like Eastwood, about the media in general and about political media in particular that I'm finding more and more compelling these days is Dylan Byers over at Politico. And he had a couple of columns I want to talk about briefly this week. In one, he points out what appears to be a common thread that many of the media were doing when they were previewing the Democratic convention. And this was the meme, Lee, that Barack Obama hasn't fulfilled the lofty promises he made in 2008, that he's cocky, that he overestimates his own political skills, he's just another conventional president. Well, what do we make of this theme, assuming that you agree with that?
Well, I don't know whether I agree with it or not, because I don't know
President Obama. I don't mean with the contention, but the fact that that's how the media were reporting stories leading up to the convention.
I think this is a good example of we honestly can't find anything else to write about, and we abhor a vacuum. Because to me, all that really is badly done flackery, badly done opinion. If you want to say that President Obama is cocky, why don't you go report a story that demonstrates that? If you want to say that he's just an average president, why don't you round up a bunch of people who are good at evaluating presidencies and talk to them rather than sort of putting it out in that way?
You know, I guess I don't think that the stories were poorly sourced. I mean, to me, Charles, it just seemed to say this is sort of the standard that we operate when we're covering conventions, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. Write something negative about the candidates, you know, show their warts, show the challenges to them, then pump them up with the speeches, then knock them down. I mean, it's kind of the same old pattern.
It is. I mean, you know, it's the classic pseudo event, and we approach it with this sort of template in hand, knowing full well how the script is going to play out, right? Obama's such a disappointment. And then 3 days later, wait a minute, we're reevaluating based on the evidence. And, you know, part of that's good, though. It forces the incumbent or the challenger to lay the evidence out before the American people. This is what I've done. And when you have the microphone for a couple of days and you can do that free from kind of the counter narrative, you control the narrative for a few days. It's your opportunity. And a lot of that is theater. And but in this network to social network environment in which we are discussing, it's really important to provide that kind of evidence because that's what will be chewed over a month from now.
But Charles, I think that a lot of the evidence that, quote, is being provided is already out there.
Oh, sure.
And it's, I mean, journalistically, it seems to be that, it seems to me that the obligation is you don't wait for it to get provided, you go out and discover
it. The theater of the presentation in which it is organized sort of from end to end and the counter narrative is built by, you know, there's this moment where it's like, you be quiet. Now, for 3 days, we're going to make our argument. And one side does, and then the other side does. And I do think that that's pretty instructional, just in the totality of the argument being built.
Well, another theme that we mentioned at the top of the show, Lee, that's emerging from both of the conventions so far is this blatant appeal to women voters. We had Ann Romney's introduction of her husband and last night Michelle Obama's defense of her husband. Well, Jennifer Vanasco, who writes at the Columbia Journalism Review, I thought brought up a very interesting point about these appeal to women stories. I mean, she says that there are several examples that she quoted where the first person quoted in the story, maybe the second and the third person quoted in the story, are all men. They're political consultants for the most part, but there are very few quotes in these stories that she highlighted, at least, that were women political consultants, that were women delegates actually on the floor of the convention reacting to the speeches, let alone real women voters who might be influenced by Ann Romney or Michelle Obama.
Well, I think this is part and parcel of something that we talked about last week, which is that most of the political journalists who are covering these stories happen to be men. And it's not that men can't speak for women's issues and that women can't speak for men's issues, but I think that there is some level of, well, wouldn't it make sense to go to your best source? I don't know that political consultancy is equally split between men and women, but certainly to go, if you just look at the visual images of the delegates in both conventions, there were plenty of women there to talk to, and I don't understand why we're not.
Yeah, even if you just take sort of gender out of the equation, if you're trying to prove a story about the campaigns making appeal to one block of voters, why wouldn't you talk to the delegates or the voters who make up that block?
That's baffling because they're sitting in the audience. I mean, how hard is it? You just walk out and there they are.
Now, I must say there have been some exceptions. I don't know if it's because anybody was reacting to the criticism, but last night the media were in full comparison mode in this sort of appeals to women theme. We had, for example, CNN conservative commentator Margaret Hoover, who was really pretty less than completely smitten by Ann Romney a week ago, but here's how she reacted this morning to Michelle Obama's speech.
Look, I think they are both wonderful ambassadors of their husbands. I think that Michelle Obama, I think, might have even done a better job than Ann Romney of personalizing and serving as a character witness to her husband's successes. Interestingly, I think she didn't get into any of the policy. I mean, we actually know who her husband is. He's been the president for 4 years. But she told us again anyway, without getting into any of what she saw over the last 4 years as a character witness of the difficult decisions her husband made. She didn't mention Osama bin Laden. She didn't mention cars. She didn't mention stimulus. She just sort of in an overarching way talked about the difficult decisions she's made.
Now, I don't know how illuminating that analysis was, but if you were watching this on video, you saw one male reporter talking to three women reporters, at least, about this notion of appealing to women. But the other thing that kind of came up last night, and again, it always goes back to this sort of theme of, are the media, quote, Charles, in the tank for Obama? Well, we did see that, you know, last week when Ann Romney spoke, the immediate reaction of the media, you know, troops there was positive. I mean, it was a great speech, they thought. She did a good job for the most part. But Michelle Obama's reviews were really, I thought, last night, over the top. I mean, Wolf Blitzer called her speech a grand slam, for example. And there were some conservatives who were suggesting that this gushing about the first lady shows that they were in the tank. There was another example last night, Chuck Todd, who's, I think, a very good reporter for NBC News. He's their chief political reporter. He was down on the floor talking to delegates. But he said something I thought that was kind of odd. He said, quote, that he could feel the passion from the Democratic delegates all night long, while at the Republican convention, it was his opinion that the delegates only turned on the passion when the TV cameras were on. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Chuck Todd is the master of the strange turn. I mean, it was only a few days ago he was gushing about the deep diversity of the GOP convention, which I'm not looking at the same screen he was looking at. I mean, I guess maybe the speakers, but certainly not the audience. He's really capable of some strange analytics. And talking about how hard a crowd is cheering, whether or not the red light is on or not, is a weird analytic for measuring passion.
But, I mean, it did, Lee, suggest to some people, and I think you could draw that inference if you wanted to, that, you know, the suggestion was that Republicans are wooden and only care about the cameras and the stagecraft, while the Democrats are truly passionately engaged. And, you know, that kind of runs against that meme we were talking about earlier, that they want to beat down President Obama.
I don't know. I don't pay that much attention to Todd's, what do I want to say, metaphors. I pay some attention to his reporting. But I think it, you know, some of that is just the fact that in that the two parties are different, and that the information that they got that night of the convention was very different. It would have been hard, I think, to be a Democrat and be presented with the kind of speeches, especially about, for example, former Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, and not get emotional. The Republicans didn't have that.
Well, I would disagree with you on that point. I made a point for the Republican convention, for the most part, to watch it on C-SPAN and to sort of ignore the analysts from either side. And if you watch the coverage of all the speeches, not just the few that the media wanted you to see, but all the speeches, there was plenty of passion and cheering from the Republicans as well as the Democrats. That just seems like that's a false equivalence.
Well, I get, okay, Mike, I guess we're going to agree to disagree, because I think this is one of those things where, yeah, there was plenty of cheering. I don't disagree with that. But getting at that deep core that sort of combines a notion of history and somebody who's an elder statesman, I don't think the Republicans had that person, okay? Mm-hmm. That's an accident of history. It's not their fault. It doesn't make them wooden, okay? I'm not rooting for some important Republican senator to go out and die so they can get that. I just think that this is in some ways it's happenstance.
Well, regardless of whether the media are in the tank or not in the tank for a particular candidate, I thought there was another story about journalists complaining this week that I found very interesting. Again, Dylan Byers wrote it in Politico. Mm-hmm. And basically what he quotes several longtime political journalists who say that they actively loathe the 2012 campaign and they wish it would end soon. One of the journalists they quote, Walter Shapiro, who's now working for Yahoo News, he's covered, I think, 9 presidential candidates and campaigns. He put it this way: this is worse than normal, a lot less fun, and it feels impossible for us to change the conversation.
I talked out loud to the computer as I read this story, as I sometimes do. And I'm sure people walked by my office and wondered why I was screaming. This is the most pathetically unself-aware group of spoiled brats that I could ever imagine. In the last 5 years, literally thousands of their colleagues, each of whom would give their right arm to be paid to do daily journalism, are being forced to do other things for a living now by the economics of our craft. And these people have the temerity to talk about what a drag it is to be paid and cover a convention in North Carolina where they are fed and given every plush toy imaginable. It just made me sick, literally.
Oh, but gee, Lee, I mean, they're faced with the 24/7 news cycle and these terrible Twitter bursts, and the candidates won't talk to them anymore, and everything is so scripted.
You know what? All true. And my response, Charles talked to his computer. I sort of said, you know what? I can walk out the door and find 10 journalism students who will volunteer to do your job for room, board, and nothing else, and I guarantee you they won't complain and they won't be bored. And I mean, Walter Shapiro has covered a lot of conventions. I'm sure that in some ways it's a deeper critique than the surface part of it that we're giving him credit for. It, you know, conventions now may be far more scripted than they were. That would be 36 years ago when he covered his first one. So I'm not saying that there's not necessarily something to it, but I mean, I agree with Charles. You know, it's like, this is a plum job. If you don't like it, give it to somebody else.
I mean, I have to say, it seems to me that the media coverage, especially the television media coverage, although not exclusively TV, is also very, very scripted. You know, at every convention now, the media organizations have their little watch parties, and they have their certain mm-hmm. people that they trot out. And I sympathized with the point of view that Roger Simon, who was also writing in Politico, said. But he said, get over it, you know.
Amen.
You suck it up. Quit whining. I mean, after all, is it the candidate's fault that there's so much branding going on and you know, and all of this, you know, focus on the entertainment aspects and the argumentation and all of that? You know, it seems to me that here was this quote that I really found entertaining. We want a campaign less nasty, less partisan, and more elevated. Sure we do. We would much rather that the whole campaign focus on energy, the environment, and education so we can call the professor of advanced thinking at the Institute for Advanced Thought and quote her. Please.
I think it's also worth noting, and this is a low blow, but I'll go there. There are reporters in Afghanistan and Syria and Iraq right now who I would imagine would also trade with these fat cats in the 4-star hotels in North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, I think if we would just focus a little less on optics, I'm really tired of that word. If nobody ever uses that word again in relation to a story, I'll be happy. But contrary to what Roger Simon is saying, and his cynicism is, well, you know, merited, but I think if journalists would do more of a job covering the real issues of a campaign, at the very least, we'd be more respected if maybe we weren't having any more fun while doing it.
Well, and I think that the interesting thing is you go to C-SPAN, I pretty much keep it on PBS, in part because I'm not necessarily avoiding all the commercials, but avoiding a lot of them, but also because they're actually willing to sit down and talk with people at length and ask what may not be the most probing questions in the world, but certainly different questions that are being asked on the mainstream media. So, I mean, I think the fact that there are those of us who have maybe some level of knowledge that are going to non-traditional sources is an indication of some of what's going wrong.
Well, at least one well-known political journalist doesn't have to worry about grinding it out for the rest of the campaign.
Yeah.
David Chalian, who's now the Washington Bureau Chief for Yahoo News, but he's also worked at PBS and ABC News. Well, he was preparing for a conference call last week from the GOP convention, and speaking into an open microphone, he said of that night's program that with Tropical Storm Isaac heading their way, the Republicans were, quote, happy to have a party with black people drowning. Yahoo immediately fired Chalian, and herein, I think, lies the lesson for other journalists, as David Drucker, a staff writer for Roll Call, put it to Howard Kurtz on CNN's Reliable Sources.
I don't know how many times per week I write up an email with a snarky joke to somebody or a tweet that's snarky or sarcastic, and then I delete it. Because you have to be careful how your words are going to be interpreted and represented. And had he simply made a joke or just discussed on the open mic about, gee, I wonder what the political optics are like, I don't think it would have been an issue. But what he said was horrible.
Bully, and when are we going to learn the lesson about open microphones and people running around with cell phones that also double as audio and video recorders?
I think there's two lessons we have to learn here. And the first one is actually an unlearning lesson that I would have to do. If you worked in a newsroom for any amount of time, you get what's called newsroom humor, which is, I understand, in medical schools, there's medical humor, and it serves the same purpose. It is snarky, awful, terrible jokes that in some way relieve the tension and relieve stress. I think those are pretty much out of bounds now. I think that, you know, his notion that, well, I write them and I hit the delete key and I'm going, oh dear, that means it's still somewhere in the system. You know, the delete key is not adequate. The second thing, though, is that if at some level that's the kernel of analysis, then for goodness sake, turn it into a story. Don't just do a one-off. Actually act as if it could be meaningful.
I mean, Charles, I don't want journalists to become dull, lifeless, humorless drones when they're doing their job. And we told jokes when I was a working journalist. We said things that you would never want the public to hear. For example, we would refer sometimes to fire victims as crispy critters. You would never, ever, ever want the public to hear you say something like that out loud. But surely journalists now, even those ones from the print world who are now sitting more and more in front of microphones, ought to know the dangers.
That's part of it. I mean, that's a huge point, Mike. You got a print creature, And print creatures are dark. I mean, they are. When you get to newsroom humor, that's some dark humor there. There was a guy in every newsroom or a gal in every newsroom I ever worked in or been around that couldn't do it. Like, there would be the moment, and they would come up, and they'd be like, here's my piece of dark newsroom humor, and they would say it, and everybody would go, dude, that's just offensive. And I have a feeling this might be the guy, because that's not funny. It's just horrible. Second of all, if you're standing in a public place uttering these things, you clearly have no sense of decorum. And that, coupled with inoffensive humor, I don't know, when I read it, I went, see ya. You know, because that's one of those where you do the crime, you do the time.
But I think the second element of this is we are not used to being the story. Right. And we kind of need to get over that.
Right. And I understand there were some folks who were defending Chalian as an individual. They'd worked with him. They thought he was a good journalist who did a dumb thing. But some of the defenses, I thought, kind of crossed the line to suggest that, well, we all have opinions. And now those opinions are being choked off because of all this focus on us being the story. Never should our opinions in a straight news story be out there for everybody to look at, I think.
Well, I think if you're gonna make it out there for everybody to look at, and I think they often are, whether we want to admit it or not, then it needs to be labeled as such, or you need to own it. Mm. You know, I mean, the referring to victims of auto accidents as crispy critters is one kind of thing, but we have opinions that creep into news copy all the time that are not necessarily in your face offensive, but they're there.
Well, here's one more journalistic mistake that came to light this week, although it happened a year ago. It didn't become a firing offense in this instance. But New York Times national security reporter Mark Mazzetti was asked by his famous colleague and opinion writer Maureen Dowd to check a fact for a column she was writing on how the Obama intelligence apparatus appeared to be helping Hollywood pump up the Osama bin Laden killing. Well, Mazzetti contacted a spokeswoman at the CIA, a source of his, but rather than seek confirmation on a specific passage in Dowd's column, he sent her the whole thing, Charles. And, you know, it was before it was published. He apologized for it, said it was a mistake, he'd never do it again, and his editors kind of defended him along the same lines. It was wrong, but we'll never do it again. Did they handle that properly? What level of error was that?
I thought so. Glenn Greenwald wanted to execute the guy in the column, and he is in rare form on this one, and he sees it as evidence of this grand conspiracy that somehow probably has ties to WikiLeaks somehow, but I don't see it. I think it was a screw-up. It's the kind of screw-up where an editor calls you in, chews you, and you walk trembling out back to your desk, thankful to still have a job. It was a mistake. A rather significant mistake. He could have checked that fact very easily without sending the whole column. That said, it's a Maureen Dowd column, not exactly spy versus spy stuff.
I know, Charles, but I see this is a place where if you put this offense together with what we were talking about previously, I'm sorry, both of these people, in my view, deserve to lose their jobs. This is one more, to me, instance of probably how it's done in a way that most of us don't know, especially because it's national security stuff. And I bet that, okay, this is an instance, and I think the reason that we're talking about it is because it became public. I'm not sure that it doesn't happen a lot.
Well, that's going to have to be it for this week's show. There's a lot more to say about that, and maybe we'll get around to it next week. I hope we offered at least a few nuggets of value, thanks to Lee and Charles, also to our technical pros, Travis McMillan with RJI, and Pat Akers with KBIA. We've posted several stories, as well as video clips related to today's topics, under the Talk Shows tab on KBIA.org. Take a look, and you can even leave us a comment, ask us a question, or make some suggestions for the show. If you'd prefer, we also will appreciate hearing from you at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.